Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Family Safety Center has recently moved to a much larger facility where they're now able to help up to 150 clients rather than the previous 20. For those who don't know, the Safety Center is a collaborative resource between agencies that help combat domestic abuse and involves domestic violence intervention services, local ministry groups, law enforcement, legal entities, and other social service agencies to create one place where the victims of abuse can receive help from a variety of resources. Casey Gwynn is the president of the National Family Justice Center Alliance and was here for the opening. He's been instrumental in the creation of the very first Family Justice Center in San Diego. They're now 60s. Since his work on domestic abuse began, San Diego now has had a 90% decrease in domestic violence homicides over the last 20 years and has the lowest rate of any major city in the country. Compared to Oklahoma, here we rank 11th in the number of women murdered by men, and 21% of all Oklahoma domestic violence deaths occur right here in Tulsa County. So there's high hopes for the Family Safety Center. Casey Gwynn served 8 years as the elected city attorney of San Diego, specializing in child abuse and domestic violence. He founded the unit there when he was working in the city attorney's office, who has authored a host of articles on domestic violence and co-authored 2 books on the Family Justice Center movement. Again, he was in Tulsa yesterday for the opening of the Family Safety Center, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Casey Gwynn, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich. Great to be here.
Take us back to the 1980s when domestic violence all of a sudden became a watchword. You were working in the San Diego City Attorney's Office at that point, and your docket, if you will, became the domestic violence and child abuse section. Give us a sense of what you found there and how things have changed since the 1980s.
Well, when I started doing this as a prosecutor, I think there wasn't a lot of focus on it in the criminal and civil justice system. We didn't really know much about it. I went through Stanford and UCLA and never heard the phrase domestic violence. I became a prosecutor, had never really heard it. I was assigned to handle it in San Diego in 1985 because nobody else wanted to do it, and I was brand new, so they could make me do it. And that's how I came in. No training, no experience, no expertise, totally incompetent, and handling the toughest cases that you could ever imagine in the criminal justice system. And I think in those early years, we just didn't have a sense of how difficult it was for victims to come forward, how difficult it was to really break the cycle of family violence, how difficult it is to hold abusers accountable and cause them to make different choices in their lives about violence and abuse. So we saw this revolving door where cases would come and go, officers would go to the same houses over and over and over again. And then when victims did come forward, they'd have to go from agency to agency to agency to agency and tell their story over and over to get help. And they wouldn't stay. They'd give up. They'd go back to their abuser, and the cycle would start all over again. So that was really my beginning.
And really, there was only one tool back then. It was a restraining order, wasn't it? I mean, and that was something that a judge would be very reluctant to do. I mean, he would have to have very compelling evidence to put one in place.
Right. Yeah, the first tool that was really created was the notion of a protection order or a restraining order. Then along came kind of the idea of, hey, let's just go arrest them. We'll just arrest them. We'll get the police involved and we'll go arrest them. As if taking a man who grew up in a violent and abusive home and is now in an abusive relationship as an adult, that taking him to jail for 12 or 24 hours and putting him in a cell with Bubba is going to turn him into a great father and a great partner and a loving husband. And lo and behold, you arrest him and now he's really mad. And then, of course, nobody was getting prosecuted back in those days. So all that happened was he got arrested. And it was ugly. And it's still ugly in a lot of the country today. I mean, the reality is that still today, restraining orders are a tool. And as soon as a woman gets a restraining order, she is in incredible danger. As soon as you try to separate from your abuser, you're in far more danger. 75% of the women that were killed last year in the United States were killed after they left their abuser. So the victims are all still saying, you know, I'm scared to death of him, so I'm staying with him. And we all say, she's nuts. She's not nuts. She actually knows instinctively what we know statistically, which is she's safer staying with her abuser than she is leaving her abuser because she's more likely to die if she leaves. And so it's a complicated set of issues.
And that's the big chasm right there. After she makes this courageous decision to leave the abuser, law enforcement and social service agencies have real trouble keeping that distance between the abuser and the abusee.
Absolutely. And if you think about it, anybody that's in an isolation situation with an abusive partner, and many of them are, it's a secret. Nobody knows much. He's isolated her from family and friends in your typical power and control relationship. And then she comes forward finally for help. You know what she needs? She needs to be welcomed into a community. She doesn't need to be welcomed into a process or a system or an agency. She needs people to come around her and care about her and her kids and her whole situation. And he, quite frankly, needs somebody to pay attention to him, too. It's not just about her. There's a reason she's coming forward for help, because there's abuse going on. And not all victims are women. Some women are abusive, and some men come forward for help. And it's taken us a lot of years to figure out that there are male victims of domestic violence, too, and that we have to be ready to offer them a community that welcomes them and cares for them as well.
How quick has the system been able to understand that it could be either gender involved?
I think that's a very new phenomenon within the last maybe decade or so. I think we're just beginning to fully understand it, both in gay and lesbian relationships where you may have same-sex partners. In gay relationships, you obviously have gay victims. But even in heterosexual relationships, I think it's been very difficult for us to come to grips with that. And it's even more complicated by the fact that a lot of men who are violent and abusive pretend to be victims and say, she hit me first, I was only defending myself. That's the classic defense for a batterer. As soon as the police show up, the first thing an abusive man says is, she hit me first, I was only defending myself, she's crazy. And then they look over at her, and let's say she's just been strangled by her partner, she looks crazy, and she's acting crazy. And the officers are confused, and the batterer gets to manipulate law enforcement right there at the scene of the crime. So it's a complicated set of issues to deal with, but at the end of the day, we are figuring out that even though the vast majority of this violence is perpetrated by heterosexual men against heterosexual women, there are still other kinds of abusive relationships, and we have to be sensitive to that and aware of it.
And of course, our system has really done a much better job and trying to do a better job on abused children. The other issue, I know that it's also a big issue in San Diego, too, is elder abuse.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's children abusing parents, elderly
parents.
Well,
it's all connected. You know, we're hosting a big international conference in San Diego in April of 2014, and the theme of the conference is the root of all crime. And what we're focusing on is these intersections between child abuse and domestic violence and elder abuse and sexual assault and human trafficking. I mean, much of elder abuse is domestic violence grown old. It's child abuse grown old. And there was abuse when the adult was a child, and now they're caring for their elderly parent, and they're using disciplinary techniques and physical abuse
with their
elderly parent that they learned as a child from that very parent. We see a lot of that. We see your typical kind of elder abuse suspect as a 40-year-old male who never really attached to anybody in his life and is still living with mom, and dad has died, and mom's now 85, and he's ripping her off. And he's manipulating her just like he's done, quite frankly, his whole life, because he never really grew up.
And he learned.
And he learned it at home.
Yeah.
So it's a very complicated set of issues there, too. But they're connected. So as this work has gone forward in the last decade and a half, we've realized you got to connect all these things. You can't just have over here, go here for domestic violence, over here, go here for child abuse, go here for sexual assault, go here for elder abuse. And now with human trafficking issues and this whole dynamic of American runaways becoming sex workers and prostitutes at the age of 12 or 13 or 14, you can't just push that over there, because those kids are running away from abusive homes. Those kids that end up in the prostitution setting are coming out of abusive homes.
So as you began, as this green city attorney learning all of this, I guess at some point you came up with this idea of having a one-stop facility, which is how the San Diego Family Justice Center, which is now, 20 years long now, right?
Yeah, our first co-location model actually started in 1990, a little over 20 years ago. We expanded it to what is now the current model of the center in 2002 and went from 5 agencies together to 25 agencies together. But yes, we've been doing this for a long time, and I give all the credit to the YWCA and an amazing feminist advocate named Ashley Walker, who came to me in 1985 and said, I need your help. Mm. And if you're the prosecutor, then you should be doing your job and stopping these men who are doing this. And I'll do my best to help the women, but you got to help stop the men. And then as we got working together, it was like, we got to help the women together. And they got to help us, and we got to help them. And that's really what produced the idea for the Family Justice Center, was community-based feminist advocates working with us as police and prosecutors and saying, we're going to be so much more powerful together than we will be apart. And our cultures are different, our approaches are different, but we have to find a way to work together if we're really going to make a difference.
Now, how does the Family Justice Center work in San Diego?
Well, the San Diego Family Justice Center, as I said, really started with five agencies, and we brought them into the prosecutor's office. We brought in civil legal services. We brought in services for children exposed to violence from Children's Hospital. We brought in advocates from the Battered Women's Shelter. And the notion was, police are going to do their job, prosecutors are going to do their job, but we're all going to work together when you've got a high-risk case. We're all going to work together and learn when somebody dies. We're not going to point fingers. We're going to sit down together and say, how could we have prevented this homicide from happening? And that's really how we started. So the notion was, a woman could come one place, and then she can choose who she talks to. If she wants to talk to a chaplain, we'll have a chaplain. If she wants to talk to an advocate, we'll have an advocate. If she wants to talk to her detective on a case, she'll get to talk to the detective. But she gets to choose who she talks to. And then our goal is to get her to give us permission to talk to each other, so we can all surround her with support and services and help in order to give her and her children what they need, and in order to hold the criminal, the abuser, accountable for what he's done. I mean, most men that are abusive do not stop on their own. I mean, they do wake up one day and they say, hey, baby, I'll never do this again. I promise. I really love you. I'm so sorry. I'll never, never do it again. They always say that. But a day later, they do it again, or 3 months later, or 6 months later. We've got to get that statement from him, I'm not going to do this again, to be real. And the only way they ever change their behavior is when they're held accountable. They're both held accountable, and they're given tools to make different choices in their lives when they get upset.
A lot of times when you hear hold accountable, that means going to jail. But is there other steps, like interventions, that can sort of mediate the process?
I think that jail is important for serious offenders. I think jail is important for offenders that choose to continue to repeat their behavior. But we will never arrest or prosecute our way out of this problem.
Right.
We're putting more people in jails and prisons today in America than any country on planet Earth. And it is not solving the problem. We are producing yet more dysfunctional people. Particularly men, though women as well, coming out of prison and jail, and they're not coming out functional and healthy and ready to be employed.
Or rehabilitated.
No, and most of them are coming out as convicted felons, and they can't get a job, and they can't vote, and they're not reengaged in society.
And for an abuser, that would be even more frustrating, and the cycle would probably
repeat. Absolutely. So I do believe that the criminal justice system plays a role, but at the end of the day, we've got to do a lot of prevention work. We've got to focus on children. The way you're going to stop family violence is you're going to stop raising your criminals at home. Because in America, we raise our criminals at home. And the vast majority of people we're putting in prisons grew up in homes with some mix of drugs and alcohol and child abuse and domestic violence. So we got to focus on the home. We've got to focus on breaking the cycle with pregnant moms and helping them understand what it means to be a mother and new fathers, and focused on how we get the kids, even if they've been exposed, to not repeat that cycle. The passion of my life right now is getting children to go a different path than their parents.
My guest today is Casey Gwynn, the president of the National Family Justice Center Alliance. He started out as a San Diego attorney working in the attorney's office. Then he was the elected city attorney and has made domestic violence and violence in the home his centerpiece of his work while he was in office. And now he runs, again, this alliance, which is creating justice centers, or family safety centers, as it's called here in Tulsa. And they're doing this all around the country. And the Tulsa Family Safety Center just expanded. The facility is now at the Tulsa Police Courts building. So it's right there at the heart of where all these services are located. And they have a capacity for 150 clients, which is up from 20, which is kind of mind-blowing. Yeah. There's only 20.
We're so excited about what's going on in Tulsa. I was here when Divas first became part of the President's Family Justice Center initiative on the national level in 2005, and we first opened the Family Safety Center here. And Domestic Violence Intervention Services has done great work here for 30 years, and they help lay the foundation for this Family Safety Center. But I love the way it's evolving. I love the commitment of the Tulsa Police Department and so many agencies that have come together in this. The Tulsa Family Safety Center is the best hope for reducing homicides and breaking the cycle of family violence in Tulsa, and I believe it's poised to become a model for all of Oklahoma. What's happened here with Suzanne Stewart's leadership, it's an incredible opportunity now to change the world for a lot of folks.
When you look at the statistics in Oklahoma, they're not great. Oklahoma ranks 11th in women murdered by men. 21% of all those Oklahoma domestic violence fatalities occur right here in Tulsa County. And you look at the statistics, one in three women that are a victim of homicide are murdered by a current or former partner. And one in four have experienced domestic violence. So this is a pretty epidemic.
Well, and the generational cycle of it is so vicious. We just finished a study in San Diego and found that 70% of the children of incarcerated inmates themselves end up in jail by the age of 21. So once you start trying to address criminal behavior and you lock people up, you now better be doing a lot of work with their kids, because otherwise their kids are going to grow up and end up in the same institutions that their parents were in. So you have to roll back your kind of approach to say, we're not going to spend all our time at the bottom of the cliff. Most of what's happening right now is at the bottom of the cliff. Women are dying in large numbers. We go to the bottom of the cliff. We prosecute the murderer. We lock him up. The taxpayers spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year to lock him up. In California, it's now $50,000 a year per inmate. I would guess it's probably in the $20,000 to $30,000 range a year per inmate here in Oklahoma. You lock them up, and that serves no purpose except you have to punish them for their crime. You're at the bottom of the cliff.
And if there are children involved, they go into the foster system. There's costs there.
At the bottom of the cliff.
Yeah.
Somehow we have to get to the top of the cliff, and we have to build bridges at the top of the cliff, and we have to build fences at the top of the cliff, and we have to keep those families from ever getting involved in violence and abuse. That has to be part of the goal of the Tulsa Family Safety Center.
It was really interesting you mentioned this, because a couple of years ago, the legislature did pass a first step towards this in the Oklahoma Justice Reinvestment Initiative. It's not gone anywhere. Our prison population is staying the same. And the idea of this reinvestment initiative is that you start lowering your incarceration rates, and the money you save from incarcerating fewer people, you then turn into the community. And the statistics are there. You can see where the cycle of domestic violence, the cycle of drugs, all of these things, you can find out where these areas are, and you can pinpoint them, and you can pinpoint services to sort of put the fences up at the top of the cliff. Yet there doesn't seem to be political will. Now, there might be political will on the city level. I sense that. But when you go to the larger organizations, be it federal or state, which they have to be participants as well, it seems, at least in our state, where we can't get traction. Is that a common occurrence?
I think it is a common occurrence. And it's a difficult political issue, because the public wants to be safe. And we don't want criminals to get out of
prison. The easiest way to do that is we're going to lock them up.
Lock them up, as if that solves the complex social problems that are going on. But that's the public's reaction. And they like tough-on-crime politicians. We're going to lock the bad guys up. The problem is the bad guys are growing up in homes in our communities across our states. And the bad guys need to be addressed when they're 5 and 6 and 7. And they need to be loved. I mean, we created a camp called Camp Hope as part of the San Diego Family Justice Center, which I believe has done more than almost anything we've done in the center to make a difference. We send physically and sexually abused kids and children exposed to domestic violence to camp every summer. And it's a values-based camping model where we focus on affirming them for their character traits. And we praise them and we honor them, not for what they do or don't do, but for who they are. And help them understand that they've got God-given gifts and abilities, and they can be somebody different than their father or stepfather or parents. It is transformational. Chan Hellman, who's at the University of Oklahoma at Tulsa, is one of the leading researchers in the country on hope theory. And Chan just did our evaluation for Camp Hope in California. And he's going to be publishing the outcomes out of OU. And the outcomes are going to show that this is the most powerful thing you can do with kids exposed to domestic violence, is get them a mentor and send them to camp and help them reevaluate and readjust who they are. Give them hope, because kids with hope can overcome all kinds of bad stuff and make different choices. Kids without hope go down a road that puts them in exactly the same jail cell 20 years after their father was there.
Now, I can hear people hearing that and saying, this is taking the family out of the equation, and there's such, we have such this sacrosanct view of the family. There are people, even a lot of good-hearted people, say, that scares me. What would you say to those folks? You know, because even in an abusive household, there's still some love going on. It's just a lot of times.
Absolutely, and nobody's a bigger fan of family than I am. I've been married for almost 30 years. My wife and I raised 3 children on affirmation and encouragement. But I got to tell you that even in a Christian family that I grew up in, there was abuse. And my grandfather abused my grandmother for years in secret. My grandmother took it to the grave with her. And it wasn't until the suicide of two of my uncles that the family started talking about it. Mm. And my first choice is always that we would have a home with two parents and a loving environment for kids to grow up in where they're affirmed and cared for. That's always going to be my first choice from now until the end of time. My second choice would be if there's violence and abuse in the home, there at least be one parent that loves and affirms and cares for those children. But in a lot of the families that we deal with, they're not getting that from any parent. One parent is drug and alcohol addicted, the other parent's in jail or is absent, has disappeared. And all the research tells us that every child needs one person at least to passionately love them and believe in them in life, or they can't make it. They simply can't make it. And sometimes it's a coach, sometimes it's a teacher, sometimes it's a youth pastor, but every child needs somebody to passionately love them. And when you go back and look at the guys who today, by the way, were painting at the Tulsa Family Safety Center that are coming right out of the jail in their orange jumpsuits, I can guarantee you that those kids grew up in homes with some mix of drugs and alcohol and child abuse and domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And if you really drill it down, they never had anybody really believing in them, and they made some bad choices, and bad choices built on bad choices, and now they're painting the walls to get the Tulsa Family Safety Center ready to open. And I say those guys need to be treated like human beings too, and they need to be redeemed. And the same people that talk about the importance of family values do believe in redemption. We just have to put our money where our mouth is when we talk about redemption, because redemption is not locking people up and throwing the key away, and it solves nothing.
Can surrogates fill that role?
Absolutely.
I mean, I know extended family sometimes fills that role. The foster system, for every horror story, you've got many more foster participants that are doing their absolute level best to love and nurture these kids.
I think healthy foster parent families are just magical. We had a lot of foster kids at Camp Hope this summer in California, and I could tell the difference from kids that were coming out of unhealthy foster homes and kids that were coming out of good, healthy, encouraging, affirmation-based foster homes. Sometimes grandparents have to fill that role. I'm working on a book right now, a new book called Cheering for the Children. My whole focus is on this role that we can all play in affirming and loving children, not for what they do, but for who they are, and affirming character traits that we observe and developing character traits so that we become aspirational. I love the way you're learning to be more honest. I love the way you're becoming more compassionate and caring about your sister or your niece or your nephew or the next door neighbor girl. I love that in you. That kind of affirmation and encouragement will transform the life of a child who has witnessed all kinds of bad stuff. But in the absence of that, if all they've got is, this is what I saw in my home, they get angry and the rage builds and the rage builds, and you're not going to fix it by locking them up someday when they start committing crimes. You can love them at 11 or you can lock them up at 17. It's your choice.
My guest today, Casey Gwynn, the president of the National Family Justice Center Alliance. He's in Tulsa for the opening of the Family Safety Center, which is increasing its client base 150 up from 20, recently moving into a larger facility. And give us a sense of what difference this can make, because I know you've done this in San Diego and you watched everything from domestic violence, homicides go way down to all sorts of statistics that say the system, if it works well, can make a big difference.
Yeah, when it works well, there's no question it's magic. Domestic violence homicides have dropped dramatically in cities across America with good coordinated community response and multi-agency models like family justice centers. The research is very clear. I think it's going to be very transformational in Tulsa. When women and men walk into the Tulsa Family Safety Center, they're going to see smiling faces and people that are welcoming them. They're going to see beautiful artwork. They're going to see a welcome, warm, loving, caring place where they can choose who they talk to, get the help they need, and start the journey, whether it's civil legal services, whether it's working with law enforcement on a criminal case, whether it's counseling, whether it's help for their kids. We're hoping for a Camp Hope here in Tulsa, just like we started a Camp Hope in San Diego. And they're going to have all of those things before them. They're going to be welcomed into a community. and that community of agencies will give them what they don't have at home. I mean, if you expect a person to leave someone they love in a relationship, however unhealthy it is, you better offer them other loving relationships. You better offer them a place to be welcomed and cared for, not a program, not a court order, but a place where they can go and people that will invest their lives in them. That's the way you're going to get them to make different choices. And I hope the day comes when we start to see violence truly decline. The success of the Tulsa Family Safety Center will be measured by what survivors say about it 6 months and a year and 2 years from now. But I will say I've already seen the results from your previous facility that's been in operation for the last couple of years, and all the survivor feedback is incredibly positive. Survivors feel welcomed there. They feel loved in the model. So this is just going to amplify the impact, I think, having a bigger facility, a better facility, and more agencies, I hope, joining them in this model as time goes by.
I can see where, you know, you're handling 20, you can give a lot more of that love you're talking about and that relationship you're talking about. Ramping up to 150, that's the challenge.
Well, and I'm hoping that the Tulsa Family Safety Center can become this kind of framework for the whole community for greater collaboration. It's not about replacing one agency or that agency or competing with each other. It's about how can the Tulsa Family Safety Center become the framework by which all the agencies work together, the police, the prosecutors, the courts, the social services, the faith community. If the faith community fully embraces the Family Safety Center, they're going to have an incredibly powerful alliance. There's so many ways that we can pull people in, the school programs, the faith community, the medical community. Everybody needs to be rallying behind the Tulsa Family Safety Center. Suzanne Stewart is a great leader, and she has a great approach to, I don't need the credit, I just want everybody to work together. And if people support her and rally around her, this isn't just a government program. This should be a public-private partnership where you've got the Cherokee Nation involved. You've got the Tulsa city government involved. You've got the county involved. You've got social services involved. Everybody should be rallying around this. There's just no reason to oppose it. I can't imagine. Would you rather spend all your taxpayer dollars to lock people up in prison in the state of Oklahoma, or would you rather support the Family Safety Center? And 10 years from now, we really will have less people in prison, and we really will have less families with violence and abuse. I think that's the path. We just have to get everybody to join the effort.
And in San Diego, you mentioned when you first started, a person had to tell their story over and over. Is it now where you tell your story, the person you preferred, that gets around to everyone? People start working with that family? And
yeah, it's changed so dramatically. It really has. And the San Diego Center's had its issues. It's had its challenges over the years. You know, the first mayor supported it, then the next mayor comes in, and yeah, he doesn't so much support it. So we've had those challenges, but today San Diego, the city of San Diego, has one of the lowest domestic violence homicide rates in America. We were averaging 30 murders a year in 1985. This last year we had 3. We're not to zero yet. Our goal is nobody dies. Every family justice center, every family safety center, our goal should be nobody dies in our community, because we're all going to prevent that. We're going to intervene before it escalates to homicide.
But it sounds like, as we were talking up front, that it has become increasingly safer for a person to leave an abusive relationship than it was before this center.
Absolutely. And when they leave now, we know how much danger they're in. So like the Tulsa Family Safety Center, in many of our centers around the country, we have a high-risk team in place. Tulsa now has a high-risk team in place. Once we know somebody's in extreme danger, we have to act differently. And when family members know things that nobody else knows, they need to tell people. If they know he's got a gun and nobody else knows he's got a gun, if they know that he's threatened to kill her but she's never reported it, they need to report it. Domestic violence always thrives in secret. We will break this cycle. We will reduce family violence.
Let's hope that comes soon. Casey, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Casey Gwynn is the president of the National Family Justice Center Alliance and was in Tulsa for the opening of the expanded Family Safety Center. For more information about the facility, call them at 918-742-7480. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.